Since 1957, the Germanic American Institute has been building cultural bridges between the American Midwest and German-speaking European countries. And this is our podcast. We cordially invite you on the inside to join us as we share insights into German grammar, the German cultural experience. We'll look at current topics, and we will let you know all about the events that we are involved in and you can participate in. At times, we will also invite guests on the show who will share their knowledge and experiences with us, and will answer any questions you may have about our content or the GAI itself. Willkommen to the Germanic American Institute podcast.
And with this being said, this is episode number 5. Welcome to the GAI podcast. As we had in the intro, every once in a while we have guests on the show, as we more recently have done a little more often. And today is one of the blended episodes, actually. Once again, we are foregoing the grammar piece and welcome a special guest instead. In this case, it's our GAI Executive Director, Jenna Anderson. Welcome to our recording.
Hi, Michael.
Good to see you. We have a couple of things to talk about, particularly as it relates to who we are, what we're doing here, why we even exist, where we're going in the future. Just a lot of things that I think people perhaps don't really necessarily think about when they think about the GAI. We have a specific mission. We have visions. We had a past. We have a future. And I think it would be interesting for everyone who's listening to actually dive a little deeper into what makes us us. We started in the 50s, as far as I remember.
1957, yes.
1957, and the organization itself exists since 57. The house exists since...
Well, the house was built in 1905, but the Volksfest Association bought the house in 1965.
And ever since then, we've been operating here.
Exactly.
If you were to look at our mission in itself, what does the GAI actually do? What do we stand for, other than language classes, obviously?
We are a bridge to German culture, both for German heritage as well as for modern German culture. So people that have maybe traveled to Germany and they are missing something from that experience, whether it's the food, and they remember this amazing breakfast they had at this hotel or this inn, and they're looking for that experience again. They're looking for good bread and strong coffee, or they're just looking for that sense of community that is seems to be missing so much today. You know, they've traveled abroad, they've experienced what it feels like to sit down, and maybe you sit at a table with people that you don't know, and suddenly you strike up of a conversation, and now you've made new acquaintances and new friends. And we see a lot of people who come through our doors who've experienced that in Germany or in Switzerland or Austria, and they want to experience that again. So they're trying to find that. So they come to us.
And of course, I'm completely biased. I would say that we are doing a pretty good job in doing this, in putting this on. How are we going about it, just to let everybody know what we're actually doing here?
Well, a big part, like you said, is the language classes. Mm-hmm. I'm a former German teacher, and I have to say, it breaks my heart to hear that we're not having a grammar episode in this one or a grammar discussion, because if there's anything I would say I'm an expert in and passionate about, it's German grammar. There, I've just said it. We're a small but few proud group. So anybody listening out there that has questions about the dative case or adjective endings, just reach out to me and I will give you more information that you ever wanted to know. But back to what I was saying, first and foremost, we are really about education. We are a language institute. We teach German as a foreign language, and we do it very well. And we like to say we serve people ages 3 to 93. We have children who come to us for Kinderstube, and some of them not even 3 years old yet, and they're enrolled in a completely German immersion environment. So all kids are welcome. Kids who've never had even heard a word of German can walk in and join Kinderstube preschool. And my own son did it, and I was really amazed after 2 years how fluently and how well he was speaking and understanding German. We have then classes for children then of all ages with our Samstagsschule, with our summer camps, and now our teen program is really growing. And I know Claudia can speak to that. Our biggest challenge we have right now is having enough space to run all the classes that we're offering. And then our adult classes, people are always astounded to learn that we serve approximately 150 adult language learners every semester.
That's an enormous number.
That is an enormous number.
Wow. Would you say, I mean, from a teaching perspective, having been a teacher, that it makes sense to obviously start as early as possible in a child's education with language.
For sure. You know, the science is out there that the brain can be wired so differently at a younger age, and it's making all kinds of connections that it normally wouldn't make when you introduce a young child to a second language. So I always tell people, yes, German, I love it, and it's something I'm passionate about, but start your kid off at an early age at any language, a second language. They will reap benefits from it throughout their life, just in enhanced cognitive abilities in the way that their brain is going to process information.
Wow. I started late. should not have done that. Okay, good. So essentially, we are taking kids and we are teaching them German. We're also expanding on the culture of German. Language determines culture to some degree. And we give them sort of the tools to eventually be functional in more than just one aspect on a cultural plane.
Sure.
And beyond doing language classes, we do have all kinds of events and initiatives that are larger than life, I would almost say.
We have cultural programming throughout the year. We do everything from very small, intimate events. It could be a book reading with an author from Germany who's just released a new book and will be reading it during a Kaffeestube breakfast. A very intimate film screening. We've worked with Goethe Institute to bring in films that are, you know, a little bit off the beaten track and people wouldn't, even people in Germany haven't seen, all the way up to large festivals. We are just crazy enough to do two festivals a year, which is pretty much unheard of in the nonprofit world for an organization our size. So we do the Deutsche Tage, which is always our second weekend in June. And I'm so proud to say that is the longest running ethnic festival in St. Paul. That we celebrated our 60th anniversary of that festival last year. And it's a completely grassroots, community-driven event. And I hear stories about the very first Deutsche Tage events that were produced. And it was every single person who was working at that event was a volunteer, from the potato peeler to the people setting up the tents, to the bartenders, to the food cashiers. It was just really a labor of love. And that tradition continues through. I mean, granted, we have staff and support help these days to produce them because it is such a large festival. But I think that community, grassroots, labor of love feeling still shines through in that event. And that's why people come back year after year, generations. We have people come and they say, you know, they're bringing their grandkids or young people or people say, I came to this as a kid myself and I have children now. So I think it's what does make the GAI and our events unique is that sense of community that's rooted in all that we do, that sense of tradition. And yet we're always challenging ourselves. What can we do better? How can we make this event more engaging? What can we do to offer a new perspective this year so that people know that they come and there's going to be these things that they're looking for? You know, for example, like Helga's potato salad, like that's a tradition. We have to always have that according to that recipe. And they wait all year to have schnitzel on Sunday. And yet also knowing there will be something new, whether it's last year we had a train for the kids to ride around the neighborhood on, or whether it's something different, interesting on our cultural stage. And that's where it gets exciting for us as the staff is balancing the two, tradition and yet being innovative and bringing something new to the table every year.
You had me at schnitzel.
Ours is the best in town by far.
It really is very good. There is, hands down, there is, even as an Austrian, obviously a schnitzel aficionado. it ranks right up there. But since you mentioned pushing ourselves, trying to figure out how to reinvent and how to get better every single time we put something on, given that the GAI has an extensive past, the question, of course, now becomes, what does our future look like? I know that there is a pretty extensive rebranding effort going on the back end that a lot of people are probably not aware of. Where are we headed?
That is a great question, and it's something we've been asking ourselves repeatedly for the last year on a very deep level, because I had a moment where it hit me when I was crunching numbers one day and I came to this realization that the GAI is on this 30-year generational shift. And I talked about this before with you, Michael. And you can see it so clearly in that, you know, the organization came together and bought this house in the 60s. And from the 60s to the 90s, it was a club for the first and second generation German immigrants. And it was a social club. And it was here to be a place where they could cook German food and play card games. And I hear stories about the amazing dance parties they used to have in the ballroom. And I'm so jealous to have missed that time in our history, because they would dance until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and just kept the bar open. And everybody has this, our older members have these fond memories of that time. And then in the 90s, they realized there wasn't that next generation. There's not the next generation of immigrants coming in. We have to reach out to the next generation. We have to stay relevant, or we're going to go defunct like a lot of these European ethnic groups did. And they very smartly reinvented themselves. And as far as they became a nonprofit, this was in 1994, changed the name from the Volksfest Association to the Germanic American Institute, and launched a whole mission related to language and culture education. So now it became, we're not about serving the first and second generation, we're serving the descendants and those yet to come who don't speak German, but now they need to learn to speak German, or we want to teach their children and their grandchildren German. And that's the model that we existed on then for the next 30 years. And now we're coming up on 2020. Aha, it's a 20-year shift again, and we're saying, or 30-year shift again, and now we're saying, what's next? How will the next generation, how will the millennials and those coming after engage with us? Because they don't have that heritage connection that those who came before did. How are we going to stay relevant? And who is our audience? And how will we serve them? And so those are the deep questions that the board has been asking, that we as a staff have been asking, that we're reaching out to community members and asking for their input via focus groups. And it is this question of balance, balancing tradition, balancing heritage versus modern Germany, and representing what's happening with culturally in a multicultural, multifaceted Germany. And it's not the same as that which people remember when they traveled there, possibly 20 years ago. So with that is, we're still defining the vision and what it will be, but we want to be ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. We don't want to find out too late, oh, we should have been changing, we should have been more dynamic, we should have been more multicultural, we should have been more open to ideas of global ideas. And so we're traveling down that path right now and figuring that out.
That's quite a monumental task, though, when you consider that it started with the idea of keeping the community together in terms of truly having sort of this Volksfestish kind of character with dance and keeping traditions alive, to turning into the upholding of heritage, to now being a blend of those two. I mean, that's a pretty tall task.
It is a tall task. And I do think that it can be done. I think it needs to be intentional. And I think a lot of it is communicating so that people understand why we're doing what we're doing, that it's not just done on impulse, or and it's not just done just from a financial perspective, or how are we going to get more donors in, or how are we going to get more members, but there is an intention with what we're doing. And I think, you know, as we communicate with people, possibly older members or people been here for a long time, and explain why we're doing it and make this connection that we're in the same point where maybe you were in the 90s. We're at that same crossroads where you had to stop and say, what's next? How do we need to change? How do we remain sustainable and relevant? And I think a lot of organizations are going through this, and churches, I see it with happening with things with how do we engage and who's going to be coming here, and how do we fill things that normally used to always have volunteers for? That's another big question too, is as people volunteer differently, as people define community differently, we have to respond to that. And maybe I think that's for me is the one of the bigger questions is, what's it going to mean to be part of a community going forward? How, I think it's human nature. Every human wants to be part of community. That's always going to be a part of who we are and what draws people here. But how do we define it? How do you become a member of that community without putting these strict guidelines on it?
Without diving too deep into the philosophical aspects of communal development, but when we look at particularly the last, let's say, 10 years with the advent of truly app-driven community development and people perhaps distancing themselves from what we commonly and historically understand as tribal or communal, things are and have fundamentally changed in a sense that we are more connected, but perhaps more alone than ever.
Yes.
What a community such as actually having a house, an opportunity to join within like-minded people face to face. It bucks the trends perhaps a little bit, but is that the future?
I think it's part of being human is this need for community. And, you know, the research says out there, you know, what do the millennials want? And millennials aren't interested in community. And I don't think that's true. I think, you know, they're still pretty young. And I think wait till they start having kids and families and whatnot, and they realize how important it is to have a support network, the kind of support you can't get through social media when you need somebody to actually come and watch your kids because they're sick, or somebody to you know, help you out with whatever you know, whatever kind of hurdle you're up against. And I think community is what we do really well, and what keeps people here is that we bring the generations together. And for so many people, I think that's what's missing today. You know, people grow up and they don't grow up just right down the road from their grandparents, or they don't have that extended family around them anymore, and they don't get to interact with the different generations. And that is what is so wonderful about the GAI. I know it's what keeps me here so many times, is that I get to interact and learn from people in their 70s, 80s, even 90s, and learn from them and learn from their wisdom and their experience. And I value them, and I know that they value me. And if I think that's what's maybe what people are starting to realize is what's missing in, if you just connect with your own type of people and your own interests or your own age group, you might have things in common, but you're not connecting to different eras. And I think that the fact that it can then happen in this house, in this older house that has so much history to it, that just makes it that much more meaningful.
Just thinking back to the interview with Fred Amram, even he mentioned that his range of friends, they're slowly but surely thinning, if you will. So for us, the opportunity to provide a platform that allows generations to connect and share stories, and I think this is truly where the power lies within the community, is to continue exchanging values through stories. And that's the stuff that you can't get by reading an Instagram post. You actually have to sit across from someone, perhaps at one of our breakfast events, and just share coffee and a decent strudel, cake, bread, whatever we have on the plate at that point in time, but actually really have the conversation, which I think is much more valuable than just zipping on the coffee.
Exactly.
One of the things that you've mentioned several times, and I just want to jump on this real quick, because the nonprofit perspective as such, I think in the American view, if you will, a lot of nonprofits are being seen as those who are serving functional needs groups and distinct needs in that sense, whereas we are taking care of a cultural nonprofit perspective. Does it differ greatly? Is it much more challenging to manage? Is it where you find that people need a little more time to understand what we do, or is it just the same?
No, I don't think it's the same. I think it makes it more challenging for fundraising. our case is a little bit harder to make of why somebody should support the GAI financially. And through fundraising, I've had to get very clear in my head, why? Why does our work matter? There's times when I've had to really sit and think it all through, because to put it into words, because we can say, well, community matters and culture matters, but why, you know, and why is it in some ways just as important as giving people food and shelter? And it's this human need to connect, and language, that's what language does. It connects people. And as much as we can make great progress, I think, with, you know, online classes or with different modes of technology, ultimately people want to be able to speak and sit down and have a conversation with somebody and interact with them human to human. I don't think that's ever going to go away. If it does go away, I don't think I want to be part of that world, but we do have a harder case to make, I think, with being the nonprofit, and you don't want to get to a point where you're in competition with other organizations for funding, because there's enough riches out there to go around. Really, if there's enough wealth to be shared with all organizations that are doing good, and so we, as a staff and as a board, have to get our messaging very straight about what is it that we do and how do we enrich people's lives. And that's the question that we measure ourselves up against when we are, whether it's an event or a class. Ultimately, we have to ask, have we enriched people's lives by doing this? And we do. I think language education is. I think sitting down and having a conversation with Fred Amram, a Holocaust survivor, and learning from his stories and his wisdom, if that's not enriching life, I don't know what is.
I think it's really challenging nowadays to define community and communal involvement because they are such mainstream terms. Everybody uses them. Everybody prides themselves on their community and their reach and their inclusiveness and so forth. Mm-hmm. But to really actually peel back those layers and truly think and then express what type of community it is and then to exemplify that, I think this is truly where it gets challenging.
Exactly. You're right. It was a hot buzzword for a very long time to talk about community. I think the hot buzzword now is global, and we have to be both. We've set a goal is that everybody who walks through our doors here will feel welcomed. We make an extra effort to know people as individuals, as humans, to know their story. I'm a big believer in just listening to people. I think too much in our culture, there's so much talking and information and going around, and nobody just takes time to really listen anymore, to listen to somebody and say, I want to hear your story. Tell me more. And I know it's something I'm challenging myself to do, to get to know our community members, to make time to hear their stories. And every single time I take time to do that, I'm always so glad I did.
I have one big question left, and the word big is going to be repeated again. What is the next big thing we need to look out for at the GMI?
This might be too broad, but we've realized that business as usual is not going to cut it. And just from a financial perspective, to maintain this historic building, to be able to offer the classes that we want, to have the space that we want, to be able to do that we want, we can't continue to operate in the same way that we have. We have to really increase our operating budget. And I use the example of the parking lot. Mm-hmm. For as mundane as that is, I think it's a very good example of the challenges that we're up against. Anybody who's come to the GAI and pulled into our parking lot knows how atrocious it is. It has potholes the size of small lakes, and it's wintertime right now, and it literally could be a skating rink. It's messy. It's an eyesore. And we set about on a great ambition last year. We were going to pave the parking lot, and we had these grand plans, and we were working with architects and civil engineers, and we were going to do it right. We were going to do it German style with pavers, and we were going to have a rain garden, and it was going to be environmentally friendly. And we made all this progress, and then the city weighed in, and we realized that any type of work on this parking lot would mean that we would be, quote, disturbing the soil, and we would have to put stormwater retention measures in. So what went from what we were estimating of a $60,000, $70,000, maybe $100,000 project skyrocketed to at least a $500,000 project just to try to pave our parking lot. And so these are the types of expenses that the board and I are looking at and saying, how are we going to continue to function? Because number one is our building and our property are just reaching this critical age where there's going to be a lot of restoration work required. We put a new roof on the building several years ago with some help from a legacy grant, and that was great. But there's just a honey-do list, probably 3 pages long, of how many things that need to be repaired and upgraded. And we look at making the house usable for the current generation with what's our technology. And as we have classes going on throughout the house and we have more technology needs, and how does it fit in this infrastructure of a historic building? So that means that we have to think differently in how we use our space. That means we're starting to look all around the house and maybe look at spaces more creatively and say, can that room function as a classroom, or can that, what used to be the coat closet, can that function as a staff office? And it's all being done with this mind to the future, in that this balance of mission and continuing to serve and outreach, and yet also the very reality that I deal with on a day-to-day basis of paying the bills and remaining financially sustainable.
It's the analogy of the ship that looks great once it's cruising on the ocean and there is not a single wave in sight and everything just goes smoothly,
right.
But it takes a lot to actually navigate the seas and then maneuver the ocean liner through every single obstacle. So I'm guessing that on the front end, what people see is not truly all that's going on the back end either. So there's a lot of moving parts that you need to consider to not just keep this entire structure afloat, but also to ensure that we have a tomorrow to look toward.
Yes. I mean, your ship analogy is a great analogy. And, you know, you had asked me once to think about what keeps me up at night. So if we're ready for that question.
I think you sort of expressed already what keeps you up at night. But out of this stack of just monumental tasks that you have on your plate on a day-to-day operation, which one is the one that you would consider the most significant, and which one by extension then obviously keeps you so busy that when you wake up at night, it's like, this is the one thing that comes to mind?
Yeah, when I think about what keeps me up at night, what are the questions that are rattling around in my head? And I think, you know, being a director of a nonprofit, there's always this stress of the financial stress. It's very few nonprofits that feel like, oh, we're cushy and we don't have to worry so much about finances and budget. And there's always that question. For me, it's been this real learning curve about how do you reach the balance of sort of building up your reserves and your financial stability versus investing in the future. And we've had to make some pretty hard choices, especially this past fiscal year, where we knew what we needed to do to grow. We knew the kind of infrastructure we had to put in, and we knew it was going to be infrastructure that was going to cost a lot of money up front. And in this regard, I'm talking about staffing, and yet knowing that we're not going to see the return on that for 2, 3, 5 years maybe. But you have to start to do it now. And so that can be very scary, to let go of some of these reserves we built so hard to build up. You know, we've at a point where we've got a nice little nest egg now, and it feels comfortable, and we've got some breathing space is the analogy that I'm using. Whereas for the longest time it was, are we going to make payroll, or are we going to finish this fiscal year in the red or the black, or how are we going to do? And I feel like we're not in that super scary zone anymore. And we built up some reserves, which gives us this breathing space. But then it's recognizing that for the future, we have to make some investments. And that's going to mean maybe letting go of some of those reserves to fund that time before you start to see the return on some of these investments. And that's what's scary to me about, it's almost like this, if you build it, they will come mentality. And I'm saying, okay, we're gonna take this leap of faith and we're going to build it. And I really think they're going to come, but you don't have any guarantees.
What strikes me as really interesting about everything you just said is the enormous amount of responsibility in your vision, in the collective vision that mm-hmm. is encapsulated in that. Mm-hmm. But now the underlying layer to this is not just the responsibility over the ship, the ocean liner, but also the cultural responsibility that comes with it. Because if anything goes wrong here, even just a degree of wrongness, so to speak, has an immediate impact upon the availability of culture.
Wow. Thank you for pointing that out to me.
It's just the thing that immediately came to mind.
I thought I was panicked before. Boy, am I really not going to sleep well tonight.
But obviously, it has worked out just brilliant, at least on the front end. From when I look at it as one of the teachers here, it has worked out brilliantly on the front end. How can people get involved to actually help you with that responsibility?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, for me, and maybe this isn't answering your question right away. Maybe I'll get there. But what's reaffirming is to see how far we've come, and that's what helps me believe in the vision and in the future that we're going. When I see how far we've come, you know, I've been with the GAI for 15 years now, and the course that we're on, and we get feedback on a regular basis that we're doing the right thing, we're headed in the right direction. Organizations like the Goethe Institute and the embassy are noticing us and noticing our work. And we had a moment, I would say, as a staff where we kind of stopped and we stepped back and we kind of did a survey of all that we're doing. And it kind of hit us like, wow, we are doing an incredible amount of classes and programming. In fact, I don't think there's any other German organization in the whole country that's doing the breadth of what we're doing, the breadth and the scope. I mean, everything from two preschools, a Saturday school, language classes with 150 adults, two festivals, programming throughout the year. It's just amazing when you add it all up. And to think where we were just 15 years ago, we had classes and we had events, but nothing nearly as robust as what we're doing now. And so when I start to maybe doubt myself or start to wonder if we build it, well, they will come, I say, well, look, we're already building it, and they are coming and people are noticing. And so to your question of how can people be a part of it, I think, you know, we are so open to people coming in and just talking to us, and we're so approachable. And I think that's one thing that's different about the GI is you can walk in the front door, walk up the stairs, and you can talk to somebody in the office. You can see if I'm available and I can talk to people. And we like to hear people's ideas. That's where we learn about what it is that they're looking for here. Or we want to, again, like I said, I want to hear their story. I want to hear about we get people who, young people who've just come back from their year abroad in Germany or their semester abroad, and they're so excited to tell us about it or reconnect with it. And we love hearing their stories. And we want to know from them, from people coming through, how can we serve you? What is it you're hoping to get out of this experience? And especially the younger generations, because as I said, we're asking ourselves, how are we going to get the millennials and those who come after to engage with us? And so we want to know, what is it you're looking for? What gave you that impulse to walk through the door or pick up the phone? Well, I guess they don't really call anymore, but, or to send us an email or reach out to us on social media. There's some hook there, right? There's something connection you have to Germanic culture. So what is it that's going to get you to engage more, to actually, what's the next step to come to an event, to take a class, to volunteer? And we want to hear from you.
So in order for us to get better, obviously, we are reliant upon feedback of those who we serve.
Yes.
How can they get the feedback to us? Is there a particular channel that you would prefer, or any means in which it's best received? What is the best way?
So I think we have some surveys in our future that people can be looking for. We do periodically, we do membership surveys, and we're, as part of our strategic planning, we're going to look at different modes. What's the best way to reach out and get feedback from people who are coming to our events or our classes? we have people that just send emails to the office all the time. And I can tell you, those that feedback gets shared with us. Our staff, we take feedback seriously. And we, hey, we're German, right? So tell us. if you got a complaint, tell us. And let us know what we did wrong or how we could do something, what could have been different or better. But I would say if you see an opportunity to give us feedback, if we're reaching out and we're doing a survey or an evaluation, please just take 5 minutes and participate in that, because we reread all of our feedback and bring it to the staff and challenge ourselves with it.
You've mentioned that we have 150 people coming through our adult learning classes, our German classes, amongst obviously also those who bring their children. So in order to make this happen, it takes an enormous amount of staff to actually get everything managed and correctly administered. And usually she joins us on the podcast. It's Claudia, and she's been with us the entire time. Suspiciously quiet. Claudia, hi.
Hi, guten Tag.
And you are not just the voice here on the podcast, but you're also the director of language services. There is an enormous amount of work that you are actually moving every single time we put classes on. And I do think that it is a strong contributor to making us successful overall, not just from a cultural perspective, but also from a financial perspective. What would you think the future is in terms of doing those classes? Because we're bursting at the seams.
Absolutely. And I mean, I do have to say I have a very, very strong advocate in Gina around language classes, since she's very passionate about language education as a German teacher. And my goal is to continue to offer the breadth and the depth of classes that we have now, but then also look for additional opportunities, maybe having additional conversation classes, or now we're also having some adult classes on Saturdays. So we take what works, and we know our language classes work, and they have been working. And you know, you as a teacher can attest to that. You know, you have a full house just about every time we have a new beginners class. So, and we do ask our students for feedback on a regular basis too. So we take what works and add to that, right? I mean, like the old adage, don't fix it if it ain't broke, but, you know, add to it and continue to listen to people, to continue to offer classes for children, more ways for families to get involved, maybe expanding on, you know, some cultural aspects that people don't know about. So it's taking what we have as a basis, because it is been well received, and continuing to add to that. And yeah, that's my job, to figure out what those opportunities are. And is everything going to work out? No, but that's okay. You know, trial and error is the way we learn, and that's the way we've been using it to continue to grow the classes. One thing we started last year, for example, is for people who aren't able to come to St. Paul, we're now teaching in various community ed programs. Mm-hmm. And that just gives people an opportunity for exposure. We have shorter sessions where we maybe have a 4 or 6 week conversation class. We have more movie nights. We have those kinds of things where if people really aren't able to make a 12, 14, or 18 week commitment, they can still come and engage with us and do something.
Brilliant. Gina, by the way, thank you so much for joining us today. This hopefully wasn't the last time. We'll get you back again before you know it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Let's make that cultural transition, that little shift from what we are doing as the cultural ambassador, if you will, between Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, and here, St. Paul, or the Midwest, and look into today's topic that we actually have prepared, which is the topic of
Carnival or Fasching. Let me tell you a little bit about it. So I'm sure you've heard of Mardi Gras in New Orleans or Carnival in Rio. It's been celebrated for centuries and is known worldwide. However, many people still do not know or understand what Carnival or Fasching is in Germany. Fasching or Carnival is a season in Germany. Actually, sometimes it's considered the fifth season of the year. It starts on the 11th day of November at exactly 11 minutes after 11 a.m. So it starts basically 11:11 at 11:11 and ends at the stroke of midnight on Fat Tuesday, which is the day before Ash Wednesday. Fasching is more or less a Roman Catholic or Christian Orthodox celebration, and you know, in many more Protestant areas, it's not as prominent. It's a time of festivity and merrymaking, a time to break the rules, poke fun at those who make them, and then to make your own new rules. In Germany, particularly in the Rhineland area, the tradition can be traced back to medieval times when many countries existed under harsh rules. Kings, princes, and even smaller potentates maintained their own courts.
Difficult language. We teach it here.
I know. In doing so, they flaunted before each other their own pomp and splendor at the expense of their population. And then obviously Fasching and Carnival was for the common folk to flip that around and to make fun. So Carnival festivities have become annual events really around the world, also known as Fasching, Carnival, Mardi Gras. The most famous ones in Germany are located in Köln or Cologne or Mainz. And even though Carnival in Rio is probably the craziest of them all, Germany is undoubtedly the most enthusiastic carnival center in Europe. Nearly every town has its own festivities, and it is celebrated in homes across the country with the same enthusiasm in which we here in the U.S. celebrate Halloween. Carnivals vary from area to area, but no matter where the celebrations are held, there is a lot of fun. So it's really just a season of wild and fancy dress parties, costume balls, which are open to the public. Carnival reaches a big climax in street processions with elaborate floats, and the day where most of that is happening is Rosenmontag, or Rose Monday, which is 2 days before Ash Wednesday. And there are actually, even in Germany, different names for it. Carnival is the name for it in the Rhineland area. Fastnacht, or Fasting Night, is around the city of Mainz, which is not too far away from Frankfurt. Fasnet, we say in Swabia and, you know, southwest Germany. And Fasching is what it's called around Munich, in München and in Austria. Mm-hmm. And so even, you know, within Germany, there are some differences. The biggest one, you know, hands down, is usually the Carnival in Köln. And they've been celebrating for months, right, since 11-11-11-11. And it has, you know, street parties and pub parties, and people are dressed up, and it is just a party for several days on end. But it all ends at the stroke of midnight, Ash Wednesday, which is the beginning of Lent, right? So there's also a tradition that's tying in to, you know, letting your hair down and partying before the 40 days of Lent. And which is, you know, the connection to the Christian church, but the carnival parties really do go back to pagan times, and it's also considered a time to drive out evil spirits, and evil spirits of winter specifically encourage the coming of spring and good crops, and that's often the reason the masks are worn and all that time, all that thing is done. One fun part, in addition to just all the partying going on, there's a day called Weiberfastnacht, or Women's Carnival Night, which is the Thursday before. And it's a tradition where women are allowed to cut off the tie of any man within reach and to kiss any man they want to. So women often go out on that Weiberfastnacht day with scissors and cut off ties of the men that they see. And I don't know if that is a tradition in Austria as well?
Unimaginable, at least in the U.S., that to begin yes. with. I think we'd find more handcuffed women than anything else at that point then. I actually, to be honest, don't recall this taking place in Austria, so this may be more of a German tradition. But what struck me as interesting, as you just explained all this, I do believe that there perhaps exists sort of the stereotype that everything is orderly and buttoned up and very strict, and we always follow some form of rule that's unwritten or perhaps even written in the books. Whereas we have an entire stretch of 4 months, give or take, where we just let our hair down and completely what you would almost consider just go nuts. And it's not really much different in Austria. As a matter of fact, even though the event in itself is not as big as the one in Cologne, we have the Villacher Fasching. Villach is a small little city that's about 10 miles off the Italian border, just north of the Italian border. And Villacher Fasching is one of the events that actually is broadcast throughout all of Europe. It's essentially just a big gathering with a big stage, and people just rip everyone throughout the entire year, from politicians to celebrities and anyone in between, and just make fun of people completely unscathed, where in normal circumstances you wouldn't get away with that. They just step up and they just have a ball. And since I'm dropping the word ball, we also wrap something else into the entire idea of that four-month celebration. Vienna is sort of the, if you will, the bastion of balls, in a sense that we find an excuse to celebrate everything at any palais and any little tiny castle that's available in Vienna and surrounding areas, and put things together such as I have a little list here. There are hundreds of gatherings, but the big ones are, for instance, the Hofburg Silvester Ball. So the Silvester Ball is the New Year's Ball taking place in one of the prime locations in Vienna, the Hofburg. Then we have things like Steirerball. This is named after the state of Styria, where people actually wear lederhosen and just go very traditional. We have the Confectioner's Ball. You can only guess what's on the menu on that. It's an invitation for type 2 diabetes, I suppose, but it is just the highest form of confectionery is being served. We have flower balls. We have officers' balls, physicians. I mean, it's incredible what's going on. And every single one of those balls is essentially available to the public just simply by purchasing tickets in case you can get tickets. And this is where the crux is, if you will, that those balls are usually sold out with months and months in advance just to get in. And from ball as an event, we go to ballroom dancing, which is another one of those things that's huge in Austria. I'm not exactly sure how it is in Germany, but at the age of 16, the tender age of 16, we show up with a suit and tie and white gloves, and we are being, against our will most often, introduced to ballroom dancing, like the Arthur Murray kind of idea, right? And we hope that we have a girlfriend at that point, because otherwise it gets really awkward. And we show up and we swing the leg to all kinds of things, from the Roomba to the cha-cha-cha to the waltz. And the level of embarrassment, let me tell you, it's up there, because you just don't value what it is until you're suddenly 25-ish and you want to go to those balls, and you got to be able to dance.
It's similar. We don't have the balls in Germany, but I don't know how much the tradition is still there, but yeah, there is a thing as a dance school that you go to that's kind of like a rite of passage when you're about 15 and in that awkward age where you go for like a 2 months or, you know, 10 week, 12 week, once a week type dance classes. And you do exactly that. You learn the basics of most of the ballroom dances, and then you have like a prom, like really awkward final dance that you then have to go to under the watchful eyes of your parents or your dance instructors. You have to show that you learned the foxtrot and the Vienna waltz and all those things. Yes, but you know, I think like you said, you know, you are grateful for it afterwards. And again, you know, as Gina was mentioning earlier, I don't know, you know, there's millennials in Europe too, and I don't know how much they, you know, they engage with that, or, you know, now that their children, you know, are going to these kinds of things. So, but yeah, I think it, you know, I think some of those traditions are actually fun to pass off, or to not pass on, pass on, not pass off. And yeah, I mean, we do let our hair down and we do have fun in Germany for, you know, with these carnival type events. And it is absolutely a crazy party. And if I can use that as a segue, actually.
Go ahead. Go right to
it. We have been talking about carnival, and, you know, now you're probably really excited. We have a carnival tanz party here at the GAI, where you can be as crazy as you want to be on Saturday, February 16th from 8 p.m. to 1 p.m. It is a night of revelry, German carnival style. Costumes or masks are highly encouraged, featuring a burlesque cabaret with well-known local performers electrocute and Victoria DeVille. It is the naughtiest night of the year at the GAI house. And it's for 21 and over. And if you have any interest in coming, check it out at our website at gai-mn.org.
Limited availability of tickets?
Actually, the house does fill up, so we do encourage you to buy your tickets in advance. There are tickets available at the door, but you know, if you want to make sure that you and your group of people can come, I would encourage buying the tickets beforehand. And you know, if all those things that you just heard about, you know, having fun and dancing the night away and costumes and a little bit of naughty and a little bit of nice, it's Carnival Tanz Party on February 16th.
Is the beer keller open for that event?
Absolutely.
Oh, there will
be beer. It's actually a blacklight disco.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, we're going all out.
We're going all out. If we're saying we're doing it Carnival German style, where the really? House gets completely transformed, we have a group of people who come here and change the house and put up decorations 3 days in advance.
Amazing. So just for that alone, you should actually just at least swing by in case you can't get any tickets, just to get the visual experience.
Absolutely. Well, yes. But, you know, they really, it doesn't come through, doesn't work unless it's at night and all the lights are on and all the stuff is happening. So we strongly encourage you to come to the event.
Awesome. Perfect. Anything else that we have on the docket that we need to announce?
Yeah, or? Just a couple other things. Yep. You know, we've been talking about language classes, and obviously language classes for adults are just starting this week, February 4th. But, you know, there's always still time to sign up. You know, if you miss a class or two, it's not a big problem. So give us a call if you're interested in classes. And we also have our weekly Kaffeestube, which is our Saturday morning breakfast. Again, as Gina mentioned, sometimes people have come from Germany and they love the breakfast, you know. Come join us Saturday mornings for breakfast with good breads, with Nutella, with strong coffee, all the things that you need to have to get your day started. And if you're interested in additional German fare, we have our annual pork and kraut German dinner on March 23rd. Again, what is more German than pork and kraut and probably a couple of good beers with it? That is Saturday, March 23rd. All of these pieces of information can be found on our website, whether it is language classes, whether it is upcoming events, whether it is Kaffeestube. Check it out at gai-mn.org.
I do like that you already went socially conform from a German perspective. It's not a beer, it's a couple of beers. So that right
there's
there.
There's no such thing as a beer.
That right there, going in the right direction. All right, I would say that was pretty much it then, correct? Or am I off base here?
Nope, sounds good to me.
Perfect. Well, this was episode 5, I think. Special guest, our GAI Executive Director, Gina Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Claudia.
Tschüss, Ade.
And myself, Michael, once again, thanks so much for hanging out with us. And we will catch up with you next time for the next episode. If you do have any questions that you want us to address, please bring them to our attention. Our email address is straightforwardlanguage@gai-mn.org. Once again, that's language@gai-mn.org. Other than that, enjoy the snowfall that we are looking at right now and drive safe in case you're catching the episode right around February 5th when we recorded it. Until next time, tschüss.